So this is for my mom, just so you know, every year for her. So this is going to shock maybe some of you, but there are some Sundays when your pastor doesn't want to come to church either. Just like your dentist doesn't always want to floss his teeth, and your trainer sometimes craves a big old greasy bacon double cheeseburger every bit as much as you. See, no matter who you are or how passionately you preach whatever you preach, there are days, because everybody's got days, when you just don't got it in you. But since preachers still have a mortgage to pay, dentists have appointments to keep, and trainers are going to train unless they want to start working the drive-through at Wendy's, what I'm trying to say is even if a trainer isn't currently feeling what he normally strongly believes in, what every trainer is going to do, even when he doesn't feel like doing what he knows he's got to do, he mans up, gets up, and shows up anyway. Instead of laying around in a soft, doughy lump, acting like a lazy chump, he gives himself a swift thump in his increasingly plump rump. You like that? And as soon as he starts moving it, he realizes that what seemed like a hump was really nothing but a pesky little bump, and all he really needed was an attitude jump. Mama tell you about that, Forrest Gump? All right, that was kind of a stretch. But I start there because, as we saw last time, a lot of parents really do hate parenting. We love our kids, but when it comes to actually raising them, that's the part that makes us want to hurl. And that's why on a day that's all about moms, I'm going to give every mom and dad a 20-word Bible verse that can give you all the jump you need to get you over your hump and back in the game again, motivated to do the best family work you have ever done. But before I show you that 20-word game changer, I want to tell you about a preacher's family who badly needed somebody to give them a jump. You talk about a slump. That's really it. Okay, I'm done. Not just this family. We're talking a whole nation of families. It had been years since Moses led Israel to the promised land, and more years to come before mighty David. And so this family was living at best during one of those sluggish, kind of boring in-between times. Nothing on the radar up ahead, no wars to fight, plagues or famines to stock up for, just a lazy, sleepy season of nothing but calm and peace. And as a result, everybody, not just this family, but every family, was phoning it in. It's kind of like a spiritual coma had enveloped the whole nation to the point even their religious leaders had grown complacent, both about God and the things of God. Everybody, except for this little kid named Samuel. Now, he and he alone, it seemed, remained diligent and ministered before the Lord under Eli. Now, look at this. In those days, the word of the Lord was rare. There were not many visions. What that means is God was mostly silent. There was not a consistent message from God, and therefore no faithful teaching from the priests. We're talking a really spiritually blah time. Until one night when Eli, whose eyes were becoming so weak he could barely see, can I get a witness on that one? He was lying down, and the lamp of God had not yet gone out, so Samuel was lying down in the house of the Lord where the ark of God was. Let me explain this. A key fixture in the house of the Lord was the holy place where the instruments of worship were stored. Among them was the menorah, a lamp that according to law was to never go out. And so those who worked in the house of God, like Samuel, would take turns sleeping just outside that holy place so that they could quickly trim the wick and replenish the oil as needed. And evidently this night was Samuel's rotation. He's sleeping in what's barely more than a closet when suddenly the Lord called Samuel. He answered, "Here I am." When nobody answered, he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am. You called me." Eli said, "I did not. Go back and lie down." So he did. Again, the Lord called Samuel. Samuel got up, went to Eli and said, "Here I am. You called me, my son." Eli said, "I didn't call. Go back and lie down." Now, the writer helps us some, saying, Samuel did not yet know the Lord. The word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. See, before we had the Bible, God would break his silence by speaking audibly to a prophet or by giving instruction through something supernatural. But since God and Samuel weren't yet on speaking terms, everything Samuel knew about God had been taught to him through Eli. And that's why Samuel's confused and why he does the only thing he knows to do. He goes to Eli simply because he did not yet know the Lord. He faithfully served before the Lord. He spent all day, every day learning about the Lord. He even lived in the house of the Lord, but he did not know the Lord of the house. Wow. I wonder how many of us would have to admit that same thing is true about me. I've hung around the house of God most of my life, but I still don't know him. Not really. I'm comfortable around God things, but I'm not at all connected to the God who made those things. Okay, now what I want you to do is place a placeholder right there in Samuel's story, because I want to give you that 20-word Bible verse. It's a proverb from Solomon written for weary parents, and it goes like this: train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Now, here's how most experts explain that proverb. Parents, make sure little Freddie goes to church every Sunday. Teach him to say grace at mealtime and prayers before bedtime. Give him scripture to memorize and pack him off to Christian boot camp come July. And if you can, send him to Christian school. And if he's a teenager, make him go to youth group. You do that, and then when little Freddie grows up, he may have his moments by rebelling and sowing some wild oats. But when he gets old enough, he'll stop all that nonsense and come back to God. I have heard for decades lessons describing Proverbs 22:6 exactly that way. But can I be real with you? If that's all that verse is saying, if all we got to hold on to is that when Freddie gets too old to boogie and when his get-along is long gone, don't worry, Mama, little Freddie will hobble his way back to God. If that's it, so what's great about that? What about that is going to keep me at the task if all I can hope for is some senile, bent-over, ex-prodigal type wheeling home in a granny cart after 40 years of doing whatever the heck she wanted to do? Not only is that interpretation not encouraging, it isn't close to accurate. That is not God's big motivating promise for keeping parents who hate parenting to keep parenting anyway. This verse means so much more than that interpretation. Okay, back to Samuel. Actually, before Samuel, because Sammy's mama couldn't get pregnant. And so she'd go to the temple, and she would literally beg God to give her a son, even to the point of cutting a deal. She said, "Lord, if you'll just look on your servant's misery and not forget her, but give her a son, I'll give him back to you for all the days of his life." And that's how Samuel was born. So true to her word, after he was weaned, Mama took Samuel and brought him to God's house. We don't know the precise chronology, so Samuel could have been 3 or maybe a little older. All we know for sure is the only reason this kid even got born is because his mama relentlessly and tenaciously prayed. You want to talk about an unbeatable combination? Prayer plus a godly mama. Can I be real with you? The only reason I'm even standing on this platform is because my God gave me both. He gave me a godly mama who prayed. So don't let anybody tell you otherwise, mothers. Being a mom is a high and holy calling. Our culture may not give you many props to the point you're tempted to think that motherhood doesn't matter. But hear me, there is no job more important. And then if you're a mama who prays, Samuel was not born by accident. His life began in the heart of a praying woman who cried out to God to give her a baby. And then having birthed that baby, she cared for him and poured her faith into his heart. And then, true to her word, she took him to Pastor Eli and said, "You take it from here." Now, women, you don't have to be the next Billy Graham to be a woman of influence. Just be the next Billy Graham's mama. And for all you know, maybe God has already positioned you to be exactly that. To be a mom who takes her job seriously, who stays at the task even when your bump feels way more like a hump. That's what this 20-word verse proverb means when it says train a child. Now, the problem is most people think that train means discipline, kind of a spiritual boot camp where you're the drill sergeant barking out orders, teaching your brood to crisply salute on command and follow your spiritual regimen without complaint. But that's not what Solomon has in mind. That word train in its original form means the palate or the roof of the mouth. And it was used in other places to describe the sense of taste and the pleasure of actually having honey sit on your tongue. In fact, it was used in Solomon's day to describe a midwife who soon after delivering a baby would dip her finger into the juice of crushed up grapes, and then she would massage the baby's gums with her grapey finger to stimulate the baby's sucking instinct so mama could then nurse him. Solomon is not saying, parents, you got to make sure your kids get with the program. No, he's saying, parents, your job is to cultivate in your kids a thirst to want to know God. Parenting is not do as I say. It's not some strict legalism that demands a predetermined knee-jerk response. It's the loving, ongoing process of nurturing in your kids a thirst for whatever God wants them to thirst for. So when you think about parenting, please think about that. Because your job is to stimulate in the hearts of your kids a taste for, a desire for the things of God. A job that admittedly isn't all that difficult in the early years. Because what preschooler is going to fight back when you're jamming jelly down his throat? Please don't think bad of me, but when I was feeding my kids and they were small, and since every kid I've ever known despises anything that's good for them, I would strap them in their high chair and then trick them by hiding beets under their applesauce. Don't judge me. Or green beans inside peaches. And my kids were so dense, they thought they were getting tasty stuff, and I was tricking them. A stunt that works really, really well when they're toddlers, but when hiding veggies is the only nutritional strategy in your playbook, once they become teenagers, ain't gonna happen. And in my ministry experience, a whole lot of grown-up kids slump into spiritual rebellion simply because their well-meaning parents strapped them to a church pew and forced them to eat what they never taught them to want with their hearts. Solomon is saying, parents, this proverb is powerful, but only if you do it right, by positively cultivating in your kids a taste for God. You do that, and your kids are way more likely to follow after God than if you just try to hide the beets in their applesauce. Okay, back to Samuel. And since Hannah only had 3 years, here's the question. Was it enough? Did her spiritual values make the transfer so that her values became her son's values? Well, they did. Because Samuel, although he still hadn't connected all the dots, Samuel nonetheless had cultivated a strong thirst for God, which ought to tell you something about the inherent power of a godly parent. Most childhood experts agree that the most formative years in the life of a child are birth through age 3. Meaning, when it comes to how kids connect with their parents and how they respond to your leadership, mom and dad, the bulk of your work is already done before Kimmy goes to kindergarten. So check it out. Samuel was so heavily impacted by his mama, his taste buds already trained, that there was very little the less than ideal living conditions in the temple, very little those conditions could do to undo what mama had already done. It's kind of depressing when you think about it, but even though Hannah released Samuel into the care of a preacher, the temple environment was not at all what she might have hoped it would be. For one thing, Eli's vision was failing, primarily because of his age, but also spiritually because he had lost his edge. I don't know, maybe his heart was never fully engaged, or maybe the older he got, the more bitter he became. I don't know. I've just found that nothing leaks quite like holiness. And even Israel's spiritual leader, who should have had a firm grasp on God things, became instead passive, complacent, and disconnected. And nowhere was that more obvious than in his own family, because Eli's sons, they were wicked and had no regard for the Lord. In fact, they were so spiritually calloused, they would actually grab a meat hook, swipe it through the pot where the people of God had offered their sacrifices to God, and whatever the hook grabbed, they'd take it home and have it for dinner. A sin that was very great in the Lord's sight, for they were treating the Lord's offering with contempt. And if you think that's bad, when Eli, who was very old, heard about everything his sons were doing, including how they slept with the women who served at the tent of meeting. Hang on just a second. Now, these are associate pastors taking sexual advantage of the women who were volunteering at the church. And they did that horrific deed in the church. And Eli knew about it. Okay, he's getting old. But Eli was a man of God before he ever was a daddy to those men. And by law, those scoundrels should have been dragged to the edge of town and stoned to death. And yet instead, all daddy could muster was, "Boys, why do you do such things?" That's it. That's it. Do you realize, mom and dad, you can lead your child into sin simply by doing nothing? Because you're too busy to monitor his activities. Got no clue who your daughter is dating or what she's doing on those dates. Who knows the last time when you talk to them about making good decisions? And then when your kids do wind up experimenting with drugs or pornography or sexual promiscuity, behaviors most people would consider danger signs, you just close your eyes and wish upon a star that this crisis will somehow just magically go far, far away. That was Eli's approach too. He looked the other way, mumbled a pansied little whimper like, "How come you're doing that, boy?" Sometime later, God said to Samuel, "I told Eli that I would judge his family because of the sin he knew about, yet failed to restrain. Now, note that his boys did the sin, but because Eli refused to do anything about it, God held him accountable for it. Why? Because Pastor Eli didn't want the hassle. And it is a hassle to have to deal with your kids' rotten behavior. But mom and dad, doing so is a hump. You just gotta jump. And not just when they're toddlers. That may be the best time because that's when they're most responsive. But parents, your job ain't over till God says it's over. Back to that little proverb. Because when Solomon says train a child, child doesn't mean toddler. It's translated a number of different ways. For example, that same Hebrew word is used in 1 Samuel 4:21 to describe an infant. In chapter 1:27 to describe a kid who's been weaned. In Genesis 21:16 to describe Ishmael as a preteen. In Genesis 37:2 to describe Joseph at age 17. But in Genesis 34:19, it describes a young man who's about to get married. And so child is really a very broad term, meaning if you want to claim this proverb as a promise for you and your kids, and I really think you should, you got to dedicate yourself to the ongoing and some would say never-ending process of spiritually training your kids. You got to stay the course. You got to jump the hump because your job may begin beside a cradle, but it doesn't end until way after they have safely launched into adulthood, and maybe not even then. So even in the meantime, parents, it is your God-given duty to keep at least one eye constantly glued on Junior, to watch and observe him, to spend time with her, to get to know them, both what makes him tick and what makes her ticked. You got to thoroughly inspect her heart and keep a gauge on those raging hormones, constantly adjusting your methods, adapting, retooling, and sensitively responding with just the right approach that will keep feeding her much sought-after taste for God. Eli didn't do that. Instead, he tried to be his boy's big buddy. Afraid he might lose them if he came on too strong, he tried to win them over by being weak. But here's God's take on Eli's passive approach. He said, Eli, why do you honor your sons more than me? Meanwhile, Hannah's little boy moves into the temple. A place you'd think would be a spiritual safe place, but not even close. Yet even there, God had a purpose. It's just that Samuel didn't have a clue what that purpose was. So he's wandering around the temple, tormented by this haunting question. Why did Mama bring me here? And why are Eli's sons so wicked? And why won't my pastor fix them? Why? Have you ever asked a question like that? Only every day, right? Because there is no family free from pain. On every branch of every family tree, you will find brokenness, rebellion, unfaithfulness, drug addiction, sexual dysfunction. And yet on we wander, why is this happening to me? And we ask because we tend to process purpose primarily through the lens of our own limited experience. But because we have such finite perspective, none of what we're enduring makes any sense, especially when we mistakenly believe that the story being written about me is my story. But it's not. Okay, you don't even know what I just said. Your life is not the story of you. And my life is not the story of me either. It is the story of God's transforming work in me. Now, I've got a part to play in my story, just as you have a role in your story. But the central character of the story of you It's God. It's not you. Someone once wisely said, God is writing an epic story in your life, but he writes his epic in epics. Okay, you look kind of dazed, so let me try to explain. Those two words sound very much the same, but their meanings are dramatically different. You see, an epic is a story about larger-than-life adventures that typically cover an extended period of time, whereas an epoch is just one small chapter in a story full of chapters. Are you with me? An epic is a snapshot. An epoch is a feature film. And that's our problem. You and I tend to see our lives in epochs, which is why we never seem to understand what God is up to. Take, for example, God's epic promise to Abraham that he would be the father of a great nation. And yet the only chapter Abraham got to read was Isaac and Ishmael fighting with each other. And then Isaac, he too only got to read one epoch in God's massive epic. He had no clue that his son Jacob, who was going to have 12 sons, and one of those 12 would be used by God to build a great nation. He didn't know. And so Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, they could only see the epic story of God unfolding in little epochs, just one frame at a time. And it takes more than just one frame to understand what God really is up to, and that he really does work for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. And it takes even more time to watch that purpose unfold. See, you and I try to believe that God works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. But because God's grand epic unfolds just one page at a time, it's not always clear how. Why it is that God chooses to heal your wife's cancer by inviting her to be with him in heaven, but away from you. But then turns around in the next chapter and heals your grief with such stunning wholeness, you can't help but wonder, why did God not heal her, but he did heal me? I'm telling you, you cannot understand the epic of your life until God unfolds every epoch. It's only after you endure one rugged ordeal that you realize he was equipping me in that ordeal so that I could endure and even conquer this ordeal. And that's why the Bible says that we are to give thanks in all circumstances, because God's epic unfolds in epochs. And you have no clue, but he's already using this difficulty to build within you the strength you're going to need for this next adventure. And that's why you and I have to learn to seek the wisdom of God and not just pray for what we believe is relief. We think, God, make this stop. I want my son to come around tonight. I want this ugly relationship healed today. God, are you not even listening to me? Don't you hear me? Well, Samuel had questions too. He wanted to be with his mama. But he lived instead with a passive old priest and two carnal jerks and had no clue why. So he did the only thing that he did know, temple protocol. No, you're not with me. Samuel knew how to do church. And so he ministered before the Lord, even though, as we've already seen, Samuel had a taste for God, but he didn't yet know God. But what Samuel did know was how to dress the table of showbread and when to light the altar of incense. He also knew which sacrifice to offer at which feast, and about all the drink offerings and the meal offerings and all the ceremonial washings. He even knew about the cleansing ashes of the red heifer. Go home and look it up. Samuel knew how to do church, even though he did not yet know God. Chad knew how to do church, too. He'd given his life to Jesus about age 12. So he knew all the church songs, knew when to take communion, when to stand and when to sit. He had church protocol cold. But then his countenance began falling. Right before his parents' eyes, his hairstyle changed. His grades tanked. He and his girlfriend were caught in the park with weed, opening the gateway to even more serious brushes with the law, ultimately some jail time. His parents, both believers, tried to love him through this epoch. His mama's constant mantra was, don't try to change him, just love him. So that's what she did, even when he ridiculed her, saying, why are you so stupid as to believe all this Jesus jazz? Yet, how could this happen? Chad knew what to do during baptism. And he could find Habakkuk 1 verse 5 in 3.2 seconds. Because he had church protocol rock solid. Could it be that maybe that's part of the problem? When my daughter Andrea was in kindergarten, she said, Daddy, guess what I can say? I don't know, baby, what? I can say the Pledge of Allegiance. Whole thing by heart. I knew she wanted me to, so I said, say it for me. Okay, but I don't want no help. Any help. Huh? Never mind. She cleared her throat, stood straight and tall, and said, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the public for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Please be seated. And she sat down, choking back my urge to laugh at my own flesh and blood. I said, say it again. And she did, and added that same extra line, please be seated. I waited until I was alone to make fun of her. Because everybody knows the last line of the pledge isn't please be seated, it's play ball, right? That's that other patriotic thing, right? Now, what my daughter, why'd she think that? Because she learned by rote memory. And experts tell us that rote is the lowest form of learning because it bypasses comprehension. You just skip actually understanding, and you just stuff random info bytes into your little pea-sized brain. I'm telling you, that same thing can happen in the church. We teach our kids their Bible verses, and they rattle them off without even making the slightest personal application. We help them master church protocol without ever cultivating a genuine taste for God, meaning our kids ingest just enough data about Jesus and just enough knowledge for how good little Christians do church that we effectively immunize our children from ever getting the real disease. It's amazing when you think about it, but Samuel, he still had a taste in his mouth for God and hungered for an authentic, soul-nourishing connection with God. And that's why, even in the midst of all of this rank hypocrisy, he kept serving God anyway. And then came that night when the voice called out. And then it called out again. Both times, Samuel thinking it was Eli, but it wasn't. And so a third time, the Lord called Samuel. Samuel got up and said to Eli, here I am, you called me. And that's when Eli realized it was the Lord calling Samuel. Eli's vision was dim, his life marked by many mistakes. But the man could still recognize a God moment when it happened. And so he said to Samuel, you go lay it down, and if he calls you again, you say, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And so Samuel went and lay down. And the Lord once again said, Samuel, speak, for your servant is listening. The Lord said, I'm about to do something that will make the ears of everyone who hears about it tingle. Now, what was going to make all those Israeli ears tingle was a judgment against Eli that God had already warned Eli was going to happen if things didn't change. And sure enough, because they hadn't changed, Eli and his family were going to be destroyed, and Samuel would become the new priest. Which brings me to another phrase in that 20-word proverb. Train a child in the way he should go. Better rendering is train him in keeping with or according to his way. Not your way, not the parents' way, but Junior's way. The Amplified Bible says, train him in keeping with his individual bent. Point being, make sure you take into account your child's individuality and his inclinations. Solomon says, parents, study your children so that you adapt the training of each child so that it fits with his God-given traits and talents. Do that, parent, and then when Junior becomes an adult, he will not turn from his training. But that promise is only true if you train him his way. Now, I don't mean that you let him do however he darn well pleases. It just means that you adapt to his temperament, his giftedness, and his passions. Because the surest way to raise a rebel is to raise her your way. Or to try to make him an exact duplicate of you. Or worse, force him to excel in ways you never could, even though that's what most parents try to do. We decide the way our kiddos ought to go. After all, I'm the parent, and I know what's best. So we dive in with a parenting book in one hand and our own half-baked biases in the other. The trouble is, we wind up either doing it the way our parents did it to us, or we do it the exact opposite way. But either way, it's not Junior's way. One year I was coaching Little League when Josh was, maybe 8 or 9. And one of the kids on the team had a dad who clearly was never an athlete. But he sure wanted Junior to be one. And so they brought Junior's new bat with him to practice one day. We are talking a full-size, 34-inch, 30-ounce tree trunk. I mean, not even Barry Bonds could swing that thing, even after his juicing. But Junior had to carry an even heavier burden than that huge bat. He lived daily with the pressure to be something not even his daddy could be. Parents, you raise your kids your way, prepare for a train wreck. You keep insisting on doing it your way, and your relationship will be marked by threats and humiliation, plus truckloads of resentment and hostility. And one day, if you never learn to train him his way, or to appreciate your daughter for who she is and the person God made her to be, the time will come when the only interaction between you and her will be grunts and groans. And one day, Junior's going to thumb his nose at everything you stand for. But most of all, worst of all, the most tragic of all, he may just walk away from your faith. Eli blew it with his boys. They're grown now, married, and raising hellions of their own. But God gave Eli another chance through a kid named Samuel. What did Eli do with this second chance? Well, he refused to make his sons the only ones who needed a diagnosis. Instead, he took a very painful internal look and he realized, man, I blew it with my own boys. I failed to lead them with a tender but firm and loving hand. I was more afraid of losing them than pleasing God. And I lost them. See, that's how Samuel made his way down the way he should go. Mama got it started by creating a thirst in his heart for God. And then Eli made a crucial course correction by staying at the task and carefully guiding Samuel according to Samuel's unique bent, so that when Samuel finally heard the voice of God for his own self, he not only discovered who God was, he discovered who he was. And that's why it's always got to be his way. See, kids need a safe place where they can figure out who they are. And that means, parents, you got to say it, and you got to warn them in advance about all the gnarly stuff that's lurking behind whatever door they're thinking they may want to open. But then as they grow in their own awareness of God, and then as they come to that moment when they acknowledge God, that's when they realize, I know who I am too. I know. I am loved by God. And I am more than a conqueror through Christ. And I am in control of my life and not just controlled by my life. You see, the truth of this proverb and this story of little Samuel is this. You cannot know who you are until you find out who God is. Why do I say that? Because only God knows what he had in mind when he made you. So finding God is the only way you will ever find the true you. And so wise is the parent who says, baby, money doesn't define you. And hanging with the popular kids won't do that either. Neither will marking your body or wearing certain labels. That stuff can't do it. I understand why you do these things. When I was your age, I'd do just about anything to fit in too. But see, I've learned over the course of my life that the beginning of wisdom is learning how to be comfortable with being different. And baby, I don't mean different from me, because Lord knows you're really different than me. I'm talking about you being different from the crowd. I'm talking about you being you. Honey, you and your friends, it's so weird that you all talk about being different, but you're not different. You're all clones of each other. You have no clue who you are. And I'm not throwing shade. Trust me, I did my own thing when I was your age. Long hair, bushy sideburns, bell-bottom jeans, platform shoes, tie-dyed T-shirts, enough peace signs to choke a horse. And yeah, that guy on the right, that's me. But I realize now, we were trying so hard to be different. We weren't different. Just clones. Actually, that bunch, we were clowns who cloned. Because we had no clue who God made us to be. Not then. But I realize now, not even being different can define you. Lived a lot of life, baby, and only knowing God can define you. Because when you finally get to the point that you don't care what anybody thinks or what the cool kids are doing, simply because you know who God is, which means you also know who you are, that is when you start listening to a different voice, a voice you instinctively know can truly define you. Baby, have you ever had a moment like that? Parents, have you? Have you ever felt the magnitude of God simply overshadow your being? Have you so sensed His eternal presence in your life that you radically and thoroughly released your will to His and your heart to His? That's this moment for Samuel. The Lord was raising up a whole new generation of God followers, an army of warriors who could recognize God's voice and who were wholeheartedly dedicated to His purpose. I'm here to tell you, God's new army is still looking for recruits. He's still looking. His eyes are ranging, the Bible tells us, to and fro for young men and women who aren't afraid of what anybody else thinks or says, because they're just listening to the voice, and nothing less will cause them to ever turn back. Not ever. Well, this proverb ends with a whole lot of hope, and I want you to see this before we close. Train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Now, old simply means hair on the chin or bearded one. So the promise here is not about a 90-year-old prodigal hobbling home after a lifetime of debauchery. This is a young man starting to shave. And God's promise to that young man's mama and to his daddy is, if you will cultivate an early spiritual taste in the mouth of your kids, and then if you will stay at the task and keep training him according to his divinely given personality, when he gets to adulthood, odds are he's not going to rebel. Okay, maybe he'll veer some. Maybe he'll get sidetracked and act kind of wacky. But in the main, your kid will keep on walking the way you have taught him to walk. Now, I'm not saying there aren't exceptions. It's just generally speaking, that's how it works. And since today's kids are launching a little bit later than we used to launch, maybe this hair on the chin thing happens way later than it used to happen. So maybe, mom and dad, grandparent, maybe it's too early for you to give up on this proverb and decide that your kid, your grandkid, is one of the sad exceptions. Maybe, mom and dad, maybe you need to keep cultivating the taste. And until God says otherwise, you just don't ever give up. Now, I don't want you to view this proverb as an airtight promise, because that's not what it is. This isn't an if you do X, Y is the happy result. That's not it. Kids have wills of their own, and even though you lovingly crush the grapes, they may still push it away anyway. And since kids aren't machines, let's face it, mom and dad, you can do everything right and still not get the results you longed for. This proverb is not a promise. It is a principle of life, a guiding principle that because our world is sin-filled and broken, it will not always happen, but mostly, God says, it will. So even if what your kid is currently doing, it just makes you want to hurl, don't give up. And even if you feel like a failure, or maybe this proverb has failed you, keep looking up. Years ago, somebody told me something I've never forgotten. Hope is a memory of the future. And what it means is, if we keep looking up for what we are convinced will happen, maybe it will. If we'll positively envision a sun, even though it's not shining, maybe that sun will come. If we embrace a brighter future as if it was already here, ready for us to claim, maybe it will arrive. So please, don't give up. And don't stop looking up. Instead, get up. Keep showing up. And never, ever stop training them up. Let's pray. We're going to come to the meal of Jesus as we close our service today. And as that happens, I want you to understand that the story of Jesus really is an example of what we've talked about. Somehow in the courts of heaven, the Father cultivated a taste for righteousness in His Son. And even though the Father loved the world, it was Jesus who decided that it was worthwhile to lay aside the glories of heaven, take on the form of a man, and come here to give us salvation. the Son did that. It was the Father's desire, but it was the Son who obeyed. In that same manner, may we follow in His footsteps, both as followers of Jesus and as parents of children, even adult children, who we want to cultivate in them a taste for what it is to follow after God. Precious Lord, I pray as we take this meal together, that in that same manner as that Hebrew midwife would crush the grapes and then massage the gums of the infant with those grapes, that as we take the communion, what would happen in these moments, that maybe we would hold a bit of that juice on our tongue and feel the sting and remind ourselves it's our task to cultivate that kind of taste for the things of God in the children and the grandchildren that we so dearly love. And I pray this in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.